Good afternoon, you're listening to NPR. In other news, Republicans are likely to be baby rapers, a new study we found on the internet finds. Also coming up, a woman from Vermont who knits quilts to stop racism. This is NPR. We'll also talk to three women who are partners, lobbying for Mormon gay rights and who are also fighting the Supreme Court to get their three black lab puppies to be allowed to play on the local high school football team. This is NPR. We're putting you to sleep now. This is NPR. We'll police your dreams and your sleep. This is NPR. This shit is bananas. B-A-N-A-N-A-S, bananas. This is NPR. Oh, come on. I'm just kidding. This is not NPR. Thank God, whiny skanks. NPR is like the person at a party that's sliding coasters under everybody's drinks all night long. If at a party, somebody asks, what's your favorite rom-com? And you wittily reply, Schindler's List. NPR is the person who hears that, rolls their eyes and says, oh yeah, World War II is really funny, guys. Oh, I'm just kidding. Don't get your gender-neutral panties in an un-PC twist. I'm sure people want you hanging around. Somewhere, I mean, if I'm getting mugged in an alley or attacked on a bus, yeah, I'd rather you weren't around. I'm sure you'd write an excellent blog post about it after the event, and I'm sure you'd find a way to extract the racism element contained within the story, but I'm going to need a real man or a real woman in that situation. No offense, but you know, if my car breaks down and I'm broken down on the side of the highway, I'm going to want a libertarian to roll by. They're good at that stuff, fixing stuff, you know? But hey, you're good at things too. You know, while the libertarian is fixing my car, you could always swing by and write a poem about the situation. I'd buy it. I might even read it on the air. Don't believe me? I'll prove it. Let's go to a poem. I never do this, but let's go to a poem right now. A work of Rod McEwen. This is Rod McEwen, everybody. If we could do it all again, motorbike through the Roman cities in the rain, watch the cats chase lizards in the forum, drink bad wine from mouth to mouth, I would probably try to love you harder than I did. I probably would smile a smile much better than the ones I did, for I was just rehearsing then, imagining what easily might happen in years to come. It is not just you I love, or even Roman Reign, or all the times you rattled on my window after 12 o'clock. I love the smell of rooms where you have been, the foreign touch of things I never knew until you came along. I even love your enemies because they drive you to my arms for comfort. You see, art, that's what I'm talking about. That's what this is. You're my people, arts people. So don't feel bad if I take shots at you for, you know, boring radio. It's okay. Everybody makes boring radio. This is boring radio. I'm making it. Gotta be able to laugh at yourself. I thought that poem went really well. Let's go back to the earlier Gwen Stefani reference I made, which I think was quite clever because I'm not a very big pop person. And let's do some Gwen Stefani poetry. Are you ready? Okay. Ooh, this my shit. This my shit. Ooh, this my shit. This my shit. Wait for it. Ooh, this my shit. This my shit. Ooh, this my shit, this my shit. Boy, the first three were great, but then the fourth one just really drives it home, I think. I'm going to need a minute here to recover. We're talking art here. This is Art House Radio. This is episode number 21, and that's what you're challenged by, conservatives. Now it's your turn. Take your top off and dance with the moon for once. You got to let that stuff out or you'll get all balled up and jizz will start coming out your ears. You gotta let it out. Gotta let it out.
This is an art show, Troy.
I know that, sweetie. Hold on a second. I'm getting there. Okay. Speaking of art and letting things go, let's get straight into the Satan of this episode. I was a young lad, full of dreams and bangs, when I heard things like this.
Kevin Steele with you for 120 minutes, a two-hour tour of the New Music Underground. And under the 120 X-ray tonight, we have the Cucumbers and the New Music News, a new single from Morrissey, and a new video from Lena Lovitch and Nina Hagen. It's about animal experiments. But before that, we have video experiments from Echo and the Bunnymen, Felt, the Screaming Blue Messiahs, They Might Be Giants, the Bolshoi, the Pogues, and more. And we'll start it all off with The Cure, Just Like Heaven, right after the break.
That was 120 Minutes, hosted by Kevin Seal and others, and it was wonderful. It was back in the day when MTV played actual music. It was at least akin to a musical revolution, and wasn't a channel full of male and female bimbo whores and stupid, boring urban rednecks. Idiocracy run amok. Yeah, I'm looking at you, bro. All right, I digress. It was artful, at least, almost. It was at least close to art, as close as to art as an American television network could get, maybe. Although it seemed like in the 60s or 70s, some of the shows were kind of like theater, you know? But that's obviously gone, unless they have like a live broadcast or something. But this was a time period. This was the late 80s, right? Sure, I was young, and who knows what I remember. It's been so long, but this was the time period before the 90s massive corporate consumption fetish full of fruit roll-ups and Sunny D commercials that would sink our integrity and self-respect down the drain. Back when music television would give the interesting sound minds just a little morsel, just a little taste. Yeah? A little bit of interesting music. A little bit of grunge. And I don't mean grunge in the Kurt Cobain sense. I mean like a little bit of realness, you know, just dirt. Salt of the earth stuff. Not this, you know, we have now. You know what I'm talking about. But we don't have that anymore, do we? I don't know. I mean, you can get anything you want nowadays. Maybe that's why. Maybe we don't need some sort of a central source for all of our wants and needs, musically speaking or film-wise. You can go online. You can find it yourself. But that's also the perfect excuse, isn't it? For a company to say like, well, fuck them. We're going to try to sell shit. And we're going to make money. Because if they want to watch David Bowie videos, like the one from Blackstar that he just released, well, they can go and find it, which is true. I did. But you know what? If MTV was cool, if it was still fucking cool, people would sort of be around the television if they thought it was going to happen, like, say, between 8 and 8:30, and they'd want to hear some interesting people talk about it. Maybe Trent Reznor would be hanging out on the couch, you know, with Kurt Loder. I don't really like Kurt Loder, but somebody like that. Or maybe they'd bring back Matt Pinfield or that beautiful girl. Oh, my God, I can't remember her name, but she was fantastic. Her, and they'd just sit around and talk about it. Tabitha Soren. You know, just bring these people back when they talk about it and they maybe tell a few stories about how they met Bowie. Nothing like vain or nothing self-centered, but just something that might relate to all of us, something philosophical, something touching. You can't make that. You can't find that. I mean, I can do this. This is way less entertaining. Let me tell you something. If I had to choose between me having a podcast and 120 minutes existing, you better believe I'd be out of a podcast job. And so here we sit. Think about back in the day when you had 120 minutes, a show that would play videos by The Cure or The Cucumbers or The Pogues or Echo and the Bunnymen, whoever, you might actually talk to people who were cool or had bands who might actually watch it. You're not going to talk to those people about watching The Bachelor or some other VH1 storyteller bullshit where they don't really get into it that much. You know, the VH1, the channel where they play clips of stuff and then, you know, like people who really aren't stand-up comedians make stupid jokes. I don't know. Maybe I'm confusing VH1 and E. I don't know. They're all the same. It doesn't matter. That's my point. You don't have shows that are thoughtful like this. I'll give you another example, and I don't want to get too far off topic here, but think about CBS. Back, say, maybe pre-late 90s, the Tom Snyder Show. What was that? It was wonderful. The guy just sat on a stage. It was dark. And if you go back further and far enough, he was smoking on there. It was just the two of them. And he'd interview Johnny Rotten. He'd interview Kurt Russell. It was just all these entertainers and thinkers. That's it. Conversation. It wasn't like, oh, you know, I love Conan and I love a lot of late night talk hosts since then. But all that shit is like, you know, look at me, look at me, look at me. It's a clown squirting shit water in your face. That's essentially what it is. There's nothing thoughtful anymore. But Tom Snyder was thoughtful, right? Dick Cavett was probably more thoughtful. I've only seen clips of Dick Cavett. Obviously, it was way before my time. But you had that. And I think 120 minutes was that for people who liked music, who really liked music, people who would actually buy tickets to festivals and were interested to see shows. They were ready to go there and twist one up and get high and drink beer and hang out with their friends and feel the energy that this potentially overused ensemble makes. Guitar, bass, drums, singer, keyboards, right? There are other ensembles you could use, but for the most part, it's a pretty magical format. And that's what 120 minutes was. And film took a little bit of a role in this because they were making videos. It was new. So you had people like going back to Bowie, making videos. Nine Inch Nails, making videos. Tool, making videos. It was a part of it. Now they're still making them, but it's like they get published straight to YouTube. YouTube is like everything now. Why? How did that happen? Why are we letting that happen? Just because you can watch something online doesn't necessarily mean it's the best way. I've got so much music on my computer, my iPod. I don't listen to it. It's endless. They're just files. They don't mean anything. This is why I still buy CDs and why I'll get into collecting records, because there's a connection there. You have something tangible in your hand. You can look at it. You put it on. And then you sit down and you look at the artwork and you start to read things and you start to connect with it. And you put it down for a while and you listen and then you pick it back up and you look at it. You're forming a different relationship with it. It's the same thing with shows like 120 Minutes. Maybe Headbangers Ball. I don't know. MTV2 for a while in the mid-90s and the late-90s when you know, they were showing a lot of stuff by Blur or the Stone Roses. That was an exciting time too, you know, because at first they were playing music. That's what they were doing. I used to love to sit around and get high and watch MTV2 or 120 Minutes. It was magical, fucking magical. And I don't want to be someone who pines for the old days. I don't want to go back to anything. But I think we should think about the things that worked in the past and you can sort of use that for the future. I mean, it makes good sense to resurrect things that may have worked, tried before. We circle back. We do it all the time. We do it individually. We do it collectively. So maybe it's time to bring something like that back. I don't know. MTV used to be worth something. I don't watch it anymore. It is entirely possible that I'm talking out my ass right now, that MTV is going back to being this cool musical platform for bands and interesting sound minds. I doubt it, but it's possible. And while we're talking about musicians and artists and platforms being thoughtful. Since David Bowie died, I've been listening to a lot of his albums, and his latest album, the one that came out like 2 days after he died, it's incredible. I can't stop listening to it. The videos are fantastic. I wish that he had released a video for everyone and then put it in the movie theaters. Oh my God, I'd go see it like a couple times a week for like a month, probably. Because the music is so good. And so, interacting with a friend online, he mentioned how he had been watching a lot of interviews. And I did too. And I thought, why not talk about this a little bit? And let's play a clip of one. The first one is from MTV. And I'm not going to play the whole thing because I don't need those fuckers breathing down my neck and telling me I don't have the rights to play it. It's for educational purposes. You know, whatever. But it's a good interview. The interviewer is annoying because it's like he's not listening to what Bowie is saying. Bowie's trying to go to new, interesting places. And I just mean in the conversation. He's got all this interesting insight into what's happening, and his mind is sort of wandering. And the interviewer keeps pulling him back, like, yeah, let's talk about Ziggy a little bit. Like, just go with him for a minute. So you might feel a little bit of that feeling. The second clip, I'll play the whole thing. It's about 5 minutes, and it's on France 2, a French channel. And, oh, it's really good. He gets very philosophical. And let's just play them both, and then we'll see what happens after that.
Big trend towards shops in London recently, selling art, you know? Especially people who make editions of things. That there'll be just like a little supermarket of art. There's been three or four over the last two or three years. They've done really very well. A new, really new approach to sort of... obviously, there's an ironic kind of stance behind it, but it's kind of interesting that people are starting to see it doesn't have to be this place called a gallery that you go to get art, you know. Wouldn't it be cool if you could buy a Sprouts and a Jeff Koons in the same place? Which may not be too far away, by his prices at the moment.
Oh, you have to... Yeah. I wanted to start out asking about the whole sort of, you know, glam rock, gender bending. You know, what do you think were some of the sort of sources of that? And if you perhaps could describe the reaction that you got at that time.
I think for me it was very simply a question of automatically falling into areas that I'd not experienced and were virtually kind of taboo areas for the majority of the society at that particular time. And I think I found the gay world really attractive, in as much as people were totally into unknown things in London, like soul music. There wasn't any other clubs playing soul music in 1969, 1970, apart from gay clubs. The music was always so much better. Everybody looked great. There was a sense of festivity because it was still virtually a clandestine underground world, a community that really hadn't come out. I mean, today it's a completely different world from when I was a young man. Yes, Brian, I really said that. And I think there was a feeling of excitement and titillation about the whole idea of moving in areas which were forbidden to the rest of society. And like any young person, I think I was really inclined to experiment sexually and philosophically. I mean, I was a Buddhist on Tuesday, and I was into Nietzsche by Friday. You know, I think most of my life has been like that, really. And I think it was this declaration of interest in things other than those contained by the regular parameters of society has always interested me. Kind of, well, I know the supermarket, and I know Cliff Richard, and I know my mother. What's new?
What else have you got?
You know, it was that sort of thing. So it was sort of an endless search to expand. I don't know what I thought I was expanding. But I guess I just wanted to experience everything. I think I was aesthetically promiscuous.
There's a sense of the kind of outrage that it generated. You know, there was, even as, you know, people think of the 60s as, you know, this
great. Oh, that's before openness. I even put the red hair on.
Absolutely.
Let's get things in perspective.
Well, the sense that, you know, that there, you know, even as people think of the 60s, it was this great time of liberation, there seemed to be this incredible sort of sense of earnestness about it that, you know, you just exploded.
Yeah.
And the kind of introducing elements of artifice and theatricality just drove people crazy. You know, could you talk a little bit about, you know, some of what, you know, that response?
It increasingly becomes difficult for me to remember back to what exactly were all the influences that went into the creation of that poor soul and his coterie. It had a lot to do with fascinations outside of rock and roll. Yet again, the idea of things outside of whatever genre I was in, or my lifestyle or my society, it wasn't, whatever I was close to was never enough. I wanted to know what the next thing was after that. What's on the outside of all this? And in rock music or in theater, the outside at that particular time, because it was still a very secretive kind of thing, was kabuki theater in Japan. It was something we didn't really know anything about in the West. And I remember the colors and the presentation, the ritual of it all, it seemed so magical and replaced. I think all the time those rituals have replaced my very, very strong spiritual leanings. I don't think, I'm not a religious person, but I am a spiritual person. And I think not knowing what church to go to, because none of them made sense to me in any real way, my strivings to have some kind of spiritual base were really, really strong. All my life I've had a need for that. And I think I tried to amalgamate my own bedrock of spirituality, something I could pin a reason for life onto, by going outside to looking at ritual. And so kabuki came into it, drag came into it, Jack Kerouac's On the Road came into it for some obscure reason. I remember seeing a film about high priests in Indonesia who were also in drag, and then found out that most high priests outside of the Judeo-Christian ethic adopt some kind of female attire, or sort of female, or at least androgynous kind of makeup, and that was almost traditionally part of other cultures' religions, and I found that fascinating. So, in my mind, there was something of the high priest to the Ziggy character as well. I tried to cram in every bloody piece of information that I had at my fingertips at that particular time to create this little religious base for myself. Probably that's what it was about. I don't know. Or in other words, I haven't got a clue.
You went also from, you know, inventing...
But I know what went into it. But I think that applies to any art form. I think most artists feel a lot happier discussing the process of what they do rather than what the hell it means.
Well, you know, you went also...
I know so many painters who title their works after they've done them, which is a real giveaway, you know.
You went from sort of inventing these characters, obviously Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, you know, and almost like transformed yourself and them, you know, from these super white figures and then becoming kind of an R&B hero. You know, what was that transformation about with particularly, you know, young Americans?
It had an awful lot to do with not wanting to be, I felt that I was entrapping myself. It was always very important to me, and it's always been something that I've had a real push-pull relationship all my life, is that the idea of being trapped and pinned down and categorized, I always felt would be like prison to me if I wanted to move and change as a writer and a performer. That if I got put into a pocket, if I got said, oh, well, he's that, it would sort of really... It would rip my guts out as a writer, that it would, because my writing is based on the idea of transience. My writing is a very clear understanding that nothing in this world is
a real reality. It's not something that you can hold on to. It can be something you can enjoy briefly, tentatively for the moment that it's there, love or a sunset or whatever, but like a sunset, and unfortunately in so many cases like love, it's a transitory thing. And I didn't want to get locked into being this one thing and not being able to flit like a butterfly from flower to flower, pollinating my intellect. Something like that. Had an awful lot to do with not wanting to be pinned down. Not wanting to be like a pinned butterfly. Or moth, probably, in my case.
I think it came as a surprise to a lot of
question
people.
Question that. I don't know.
Could I just briefly continue?
Of course,
that? By all means.
So rather than be pinned down, my momentum worked in wanting to hit and run very fast. And once I'd done something and said it the way I felt it should be said, drop it and move on. That was my MO, really.
I think it came as a surprise to a lot of people to hear you draw on a lot of sort of, you know, sources in black music when you did the Young Americans record. You know, you talk about some of the things that you were listening to and that interested you or that you were drawn to?
Yeah, I think it would be extremely pompous for any rock artist to say that black music probably wasn't the mattress from where all other forms of popular music spring from. And I indeed felt this, the effervescence of American black music was something that always, one of the few things that musically really cheered me up. And I was really caught up with the James Brown soul explosion in the clubs in the late 60s in London, early 70s. And even though I was working in a very sort of white area with Ziggy and his variation on rock, it never left me, and my interest in black music never died. And once I got to being in America an awful lot, which happened around, I guess, the end of 73 into 74, I just found that I was just more and more in black music areas. I was in Philadelphia a lot. We were recording in there. A lot of my friends, when I came over, firstly to America, were black or Hispanic. And I was going, the first place that I went to when I came to New York, places like the Cheetah and the Leopard and Club and the Apollo, which for me was kind of just such a gas. It was so cool because I was sort of this red-headed clown alien in most outrageous suits and generally one of the few white guys in the audience at the Apollo. And it was almost that it was my past of being sort of allowed to be there, which was very presumptuous on my part, of course, but I was very young, very naive. And everybody was so friendly, and I knew what I looked like, and I thought, what on earth could they think was interesting about me? I'm sitting here watching the Spinners, and I'm going out of my mind, because this is like, I'd only heard it on record, and they're kind of like asking me where my suits were made. I thought, well, this is cool, if this is reciprocal, yeah, I dig this, this is great. And I had such a great time.
Well, it almost seemed like there was a kind of, you know, when you started doing, you know, these very theatrical things, and then, you know, there's George Clinton doing what he was doing,
yeah.
And that there was, you
yeah.
know, a sense in which these cultures were feeding off each other in some way. You know?
Yeah, there was.
I mean,
he
name-checked you also, George Clinton,
yeah,
on the record.
Yeah, I know, I was very flattered. More than flattered. Yeah, they did. There was a period where there was a real sort of coming together between. I remember when I first saw Patti LaBelle, and I couldn't believe how influenced they'd been by glam rock. I mean, the first time they came out on stage, it was like, wow, this is unbelievable, an American black trio in glam rock. It was so bizarre, you know. I got incredibly nationalistic about it. Like, yeah, that's the English way, isn't it?
What about
you temporarily forgetting the New York Dolls? You know? It's always wise to know when to edit.
That's right, exactly. What about collaborating with John Lennon? How did that come about?
Gee, you know, it's really hard to remember when I actually met John. It must have been sort of somewhere middle 74-ish, is my guess. I expect there's a book that can tell me. But we kind of started knocking around with each other. And he had his, I think at the time, gave me, which I thought one of the better Lennon quotes, which I've said a number of times. But when I asked him what he thought of what I was doing, glam rock, he said, yeah, it's great, but it's just rock and roll with lipstick on. And I was impressed, as I was at virtually everything he said. He was probably one of the brightest, quickest witted, earnestly socialist men I've ever met in my life. Socialist in the true definition, not in a fabricated political sense, but a real humanist and a really spiteful sense of humor, which of course, being English, I adored. I just thought we'd be buddies forever and get on better and better and all that, you know. Fantasy. I know the Beatle that I always liked. Because everybody had their favorite Beatle. I never really realized that. Well, I did realize that, always knew that. But one wouldn't have declared it in the early 70s because that would have been most uncool to actually say that you actually liked the Beatles in any way, shape or form. But they made such a great impact on. They gave the British the illusion that they meant something again. You know, and we love hearing that. Oh boy, do we love hearing that.
A couple of things began rising at around the same time. It is to say disco and punk.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see what you know, how you recall your reactions to those things. What was your sense about that?
Well, I guess, I mean, I've made a detour all around that unwittingly, because around 75, 76, having imbibed the more finer products of Swiss pharmaceutical companies, I found that I really needed to sojourn in another country, in another time, in another place for a brief while. So I made off for Berlin, virtually to sort of clean myself up. My luck, of course, and my typically my character, I picked the heroin center of Europe, but it sort of didn't occur to me at the time. And what was happening in Britain didn't have quite the same thing in Germany, because equally as strong in Germany at that time was the advent of electronic music in a major way. The Germans had found their forte, and it was called Kraftwerk. And Kraftwerk and that school, that approach to music, was virtually all I was listening to at that time, and soul music. And the two, of course, came together. I remember Brian Eno running into my... He's going to hate me for this. Running into my room with a single in his hand, he said, "I've heard the future." I said, "Oh, well, you better put it on then." And it was Giorgio Moroder's recording of Donna Summer, "I Feel Love." Oh, Brian, oh, that was so funny. And I said, "Are you serious?" And he said, "Yes, listen, that Teutonic drumming, that black voice, this is fantastic." That's more of an aside than anything else, but it was one of the funniest things I've ever heard anybody say. "I've just heard the future." As it happens, he was right. But Brian inevitably is. That's another story. I'm jumping ahead here. But the music from that late 70s period, for me, definitely are a landmark in what I've done. For me, they're something that I've always either embarrassingly or
exuberantly measure my new work by. Exuberantly at the moment.
We have to start wrapping up now. Yeah. We have to wrap up now. I just want to just mention that yesterday we interviewed Giorgio Moroder yesterday.
Yeah.
It was great, you know, talking about Don and everything. And,
I have a funny story about him.
Can you tell it? And also just, if you can, mention the song Fame, because he said he spent his whole career since trying to get that vocal breakdown at the end.
Well, I'll send his record signed if he sends mine.
Yes, right? Okay, great.
So you have a story about Giorgio?
I can't use it, and I've just thought, no, I don't.
Oh, come on.
No, I can't do that. There is one funny story about, I wonder, Giorgio, I suppose you can sue me if this isn't true. I've got to tell it, just because I think it's so sweet. A friend of mine who knew Giorgio very well worked on a film called American Gigolo, which starred Richard Gere. Giorgio Moroder apparently saw the film and said to my friend, "Ah, who designed that room? It is fantastic." And he said, "Well, I'll get you his portfolio, you know, if you want to see it." He said, "I want my house done by this man." So they sent him the portfolio of the fantastically beautiful, minimalistic room that Gere had as the gigolo. Giorgio sent it back, said, "No, not this room, the pimp's room." I don't know if that's true, Giorgio, but I've always held on to that story.
Unfortunately,
I think it's so lovely. I know, but it's nice, isn't it? Fame. God, what could I say that could be possibly interesting about it?
Well, the 70s were a period when fame became, people became famous for being famous, this idea of famous for 15 minutes.
Okay, all right. I suppose one thing that is interesting that came out of writing, or that fame came into being because of it, was that John and I spent so many hours talking about managers. We both loathed managers with a vengeance. I'd recently had a totally disastrous ending and a great awakening to what management could mean. And John, of course, had had years of it one way and another. And I think a lot of what we felt about management came through in Fame, even though ostensibly it was sort of about fame, as Warhol is fame, sort of thing. But I think, again, that might have been subject matter, but again, content was really a great hostility towards what fame actually, what the reality of becoming famous means. Well, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, that's what I say. Quite rightly, too.
Did you experience rock and roll becoming Rock Inc. during the course of the 70s, going from...
Towards, for me, no, because when did rock become institutionalized as such? Should I say when the first brick of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was put down? Yes, I will say that has something to do with that. When it started getting its own award shows, when... We're going through a new period now where I think there's a real sort of exciting atmosphere among young musicians again. But there was a period which went right through the 80s, well into the early 90s, where young guys that I'd meet really were more about career opportunities than about what music they should be making, why they should be making it. And it suddenly dawned on me that the devices had changed. The priorities were very different. It was what kind of music will make me famous, not I have this great music and I may become famous through it. It's a very strange thing. And it became more and more like that during the 80s. My worst period, I felt so out of sync in the 80s, I can't tell you. I just wanted the world to open up and swallow me. I felt so out of tune. And out of tunes, as it happens. What was that?
The 70s in one word.
On the 70s.
Personality.
Great. Let me just do a reverse shot. This is
All my albums are negative. I think possible to take any one of my albums and think of it as prescient if you were to listen to it after September 11th. But I think that's the subject matter that I deal with. The content of most of what I write has, there's been a continuity of alienation and isolation throughout everything I've written. So if there is one thing that I talk about, it's these slightly negative kinds of thoughts. If anything, this new album is a little less negative than some of the others that I've written. And that's because of my newly acquired status as parent. With the paintings themselves, there was some degree of damage done to the paintings on the cover. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to illustrate the subtext of the word heathen, being barbarian or Philistine, non-acceptance of culture or high culture, a wish to destroy everything that we have created to express ourselves. And the three names on the books, the three books in fact, were very important, in as much as The Gay Science, for instance, by Nietzsche, was the book in which he said God is dead. Which was a culmination of all the thought of the previous century, the late 19th century. There was people were so aggrandized with their own sense of science and the aftermath of the Enlightenment and how man himself could improve the world. Then, of course, it led to things like Nietzsche saying God is dead, and it led to Einstein's discovery that time and space aren't what we thought they were, and Freud, an understanding of another kind of human inside the human. All these things culminated in the idea that everything we'd known before was wrong. Everything. So we start out the 20th century with this clean slate. We are now the gods. And the greatest thing that we could do as God during that century was create the bomb. That was what we were good at doing. And I think that in itself, in the 50s and 60s, the repercussions of what we had done by standing in for this idea of morality, ourselves, creating it all ourselves, so destroyed our fix on what we should be doing in life that we're still living through that chaos right now. We have no spiritual lives to speak of. There's quasi-new religions, but there is no direct sense of what our purpose is anymore. Now, that may be a good thing, because it may show itself to be that we, in fact, don't have a purpose. Are we big enough or mature enough to exist like that? Are we mature enough to accept that there's no plan, there's no going somewhere, there's no gift of immortality at the end of this if we evolve? If we evolve far enough, we may never have to die. I mean, that seems to be the reach from the past. Well, maybe we can't live like that. Maybe we have to exist and live on the idea that we have one day at a time to live. And can we do that? Because if we could do that, we may be serving some great thing. None of us learned. I mean, we're all of us learning to get old. It's the first time we've ever done it. I'm not doing it again. I guess, you know, people naturally like to make some hierarchical sense of things, so, you know, some of us were doing things a lot earlier. I don't know. I mean, I like Tae Polo, I like Michelangelo and Rembrandt, but it doesn't mean that I don't also enjoy and find very sustaining modern artists from this century. I think you have to be equitable. I think you have to have some degree of sharing about the arts, and I think you can use the arts. Okay, coming back to rock and roll, I think it's okay to listen to the Beatles, but I think it's also very important to listen to, say, The Streets, a brand new band on the English scene right now. And we can only learn from our mistakes. Well, I'd like to believe that we can only learn from our mistakes, although I don't really think that will happen.
Est-ce que ça s'apprend d'être rockstar?
In my case, yes. It took me a very long time.
Merci beaucoup. Oh, it's my pleasure.
NAC, I said, we'll play some Bowie clips, and then we'll see what happened, and that's what happens. That's the episode. Hey, listen, I've got other jobs. I don't know what you want from me. If you want to see more, you're gonna have to give me something. I can't give you all of me. Just the tip. That's all you get right now. Just the tip. Give me a little more, I'll push it even further. You might like it. Thanks for listening. Art House Radio is supported by people and institutions who care enough to pay for short ads at the beginning of the show. Well, someday. And also by people and things who go to our website, arthouse43.com. They click on donate, or they go to troymeetsworld.com, because that's what's up. They also click on donate, and then they send us some of their resources. We need your support. Creative projects are never free, so any support you could give would be greatly appreciated. This has been a pleasure, as always. I miss you. Come on. Come out. Come out to Detroit. Let's hang out. We'll go to Canada. Canada is wonderful. They're downloading the podcast. Are your friends? Are you sharing this? I hear you, Canadians. By the way, coming in a hot second, I think hot second, Denmark. Love you guys. I have no idea how to say anything in Danish. But you should write me at SpanishPenis@arthouse43. Like me on Facebook. Come on, post something. Let me hear from you. Send me some email here. Let's get some talking. Maybe I'll read some on the air. I'll do a whole episode. You ask me any question you want, and I will answer it. All right? Do that. Come on. I see you, Germany and UK and New Zealand, Australia. All you guys, come on. Email me. We'll have some fun. All right? Until next time, friends.